Welcome to episode 2 of Music for Youth Presents The Right Track Podcast with me, your host, Matt Haynes. This month, we have our proms coming up at the Royal Albert Hall on the 15th and 16th of November. You can purchase tickets at www.royalalberthall.com. Ever wonder what it was like to be a professional musician at the very highest level? Top 10 albums, critical acclaim, playing in front of 10,000 people at a homecoming gig this year? Well, our guest, Adam Nutter from The Music, will let you know how that feels. If you'd like to contact us, have a guest idea, would like to say hello, please email mfy@mfy.org.uk. Do enjoy. Welcome to the show, Adam Nutter.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Well, we'll start from the early points, just because our young audience will like that sort of your beginnings, your musical beginnings and stuff.
Yeah.
So, can you remember what were your first musical memories? And what was sort of playing in the house, and where did your love of music come from? Like, were your parents playing a load of different records?
Yeah, definitely. I think music played a massive part in our household and always did from as long as I can remember. My mum, very into music. So was my dad, and they had quite different tastes. So my mum was madly into Elton John, things like that. And the Beatles, obviously. And my dad was sort of into more blues, Fleetwood Mac, early and late Fleetwood Mac and stuff. And all those kinds of classic records were playing growing up. And then my brothers obviously had quite a strong taste in music and quite different again. So there was all kinds of places to draw from in terms of things to listen to, do you know what I mean? And things to be influenced by. And yeah, there were times where there'd be three or four hi-fis and someone sat on headphones in our house. And it was not so much of sort of from a playing perspective either. Neither of my parents were particularly musical in terms of, you know, being able to play an instrument, but they were certainly very into listening to music. So yeah, I think they'd be the earliest memories would be things like Elton John and Fleetwood Mac and stuff like that. And then my brothers listening to all kinds of, obviously, Oasis and things like that, and then Radiohead, and just things right across the spectrum from you know, that period where I was growing up. So yeah, definitely there was a lot of music in the house, so to speak.
With the bands you mentioned there, it's quite classic songwriting, which is quite interesting. I have sort of a theory that a lot of my favourite bands, you know, including yourselves and including sort of big bands I can think of, they've all sort of, they're friends first, and then, you know, they meet at school or they meet in the younger years, which you guys definitely did. I was looking through some photos today just from back in the day, and you were so young, but you do look so young in some of those photos. So basically what I'm coming to with this next question is, you were at the same school except for Phil, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
I couldn't find any sort of information about this in my research, but when did the sort of embryo start of the band sort of come around at school? Like, were you sort of bashing around songs in the music room? Like, who was playing instruments first? Like, how did the sort of early form of the band take shape?
It was effectively, I very much, as you say, we were knocking around the music block and spending lunch times in there and just everyone playing different instruments. And then I knew Rob was a great singer and loved his voice, and I knew Stu started learning to play bass at the same time that I started learning to play guitar, and then Robert knew Phil at the drummer, so it was kind of very organic in that sense. And me and Robert started doing music GCSE together in the same class, so you know, obviously whenever it was a practical thing, which was most of the time, I'd be playing guitar and Robert would be singing, and we'd write a song in the hour lesson, and it'd take a lot less than an hour. And, you know, half the time we'd end, you know, you'd go and do your performances at the end of the lesson or whatever. So that, I think the songwriting element and embryo came from there, because I was just discovering, or, you know, I was discovering how to put chords together. It didn't take me long to learn how to play guitar and voice chords, to be honest. It probably only took me about 3 months. And then it was a case of, right, well, I want to experiment with this now and put different things together. And I was always obsessed with, like, effects, do you know what I mean? Effects pedals and stuff, and making a load of delays and big sounds. And just, I've got my own sort of unique style, I suppose, that I've that has always just been instinct to me. But yeah, so I was interested in those things. And then, as I say, we were writing in the music block, and then we were playing with Stu, and then Rob knew Phil. And then it was a case of, I mean, Rob, you know, obviously Rob's a great singer, and he was in and out of bands, and his dad at that point was very involved in helping, you know, get gigs and things like that. So I think with the help of, so Robert's dad knew all the places we could practice, do you know what I mean? He knew all the pubs and other places we could go play above or in the church hall, do you know what I mean? Knew the people to speak to there. So it was very easy to take that drive of what we are. Because I think the unique thing about, well, I say the unique thing, the thing that brought us together as much as anything was a desire to not just end up spending all your time on street corners, do you know what I mean? Whatever, like, getting drunk and stuff like that. I mean, it was certainly at that age, we were much more driven by being in a room and just able to make some noise, vibe on it, do you know what I mean? For lack of a better word. But that's where the band came from. It came from like a collective drive among all four of us to explore our instruments, kind of try and outdo each other, and, you know, in a playfully competitive way, in the same way that football players on the same team will try and outdo each other. It's always a case of, oh yeah, I'll show you I can do this, and other ones like, well, I can do this, and before you know it, you've got, you know, something like The Dance, which is a perfect example, one of the first things we wrote collectively as a band, and it's just basically all of us trying to outdo each other and show off to the other one. And it was just an instinct, really. It was something that came naturally to us in terms of having that desire to do it. You know what I mean? I think the problem is with a lot of people that want to be involved in band or music or anything like that, or the music industry, is it's like they want to be involved rather than they've got an obsession about chasing great music and how to make great music. And that's the only obsession you can have if you ever want to, in my opinion, you know, I'm probably jumping forward questions here, but certainly to succeed as an artist, you've got to have a clear, driven goal. And it can be a goal that changes. It doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to come up with a master plan straight away. You have to have the drive to chase, you know, to chase better songs, better riffs, better drum beats, better bass lines, whatever you want. As long as you're creating something that you believe in, at that point, you start to have a chance then. And obviously, there's a lot of hard work involved, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I'm probably jumping ahead in terms of the questions. I can't actually remember what the question was.
No, it's really interesting. It was just, the question was just about like how you sort of came together in sort of school days as a band. But one thing I've always thought about your playing is the sort of magic of it, as it were, is the sort of sonic soundscapes you create with your effects and stuff. And I certainly mean this as a massive compliment. It's got like an essence of like Nick McKay about The Verve. I love what you said about the sort of instinctual side of music, because I don't think a lot of people talk about that enough. I think even now, like a lot of the young musicians we work with, it's always just about, oh, desperate. It's still, even at this point, even with the scene completely changing on its head in terms of the online thing, it's still all about, I want a deal. It's like, you should be wanting to write something great first, surely.
Carry on, yeah.
Oh, no, that was just, no, just well,
I was going to say, like, you can't go out there thinking, I want a deal. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't work like that, really. And I think that's what I'm saying about the people who are just like, yeah, I want to wear a leather jacket and, you know, have floppy hair that I'm always flicking at. I want to do X, Y, and Z. And don't get me wrong, right? There is a way through like that, but you have to be such a character. You have to be a Carl Barrett from the Liberal. Although that's not fair, because, you know, taste aside, you know, you can't deny great lyrics and catchy hooks, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a bad example, but I'm just talking like you can get away on pure vibe if your vibe's good enough, I think. Do you know what I mean? But I think what separates us massively, we lived in a bubble where we just wanted to, like I say, outdo each other and get to the end of a jam and just look at each other and go, flipping heck. Do you know what I mean? That was something else, that let's do it again. Or in fact, let's do something else. But that was an obsession of mine back in the day, was you know, you'd always do something amazing, and then when you try to do it again, it's like, oh, someone's not doing something the same. But very much has to be a creative drive rather than I just want to be really cool, look cool, you know, like get loads of girls or whatever. That's not anything that ever drove us. We were kind of like just pleasing ourselves in a bubble, playing great music, and then it was other people came to us and went, you are amazing, come do this. And we were always from the off, not reluctant, but it's not like we ever went to anyone and begged it, like, please give us a deal, or please let us play your venue. It was the other way around. People were begging us, begging to sign us. We had every record company in, you know, not just this territory, but globally, trying to sign us when we were 16, 17, 18. We got held back 2 years until we were 18 by our management. You know, we were that good at 15, 16, very late 15, early 16, we were that good. That's when we wrote the majority of our first album. As I say, we were literally held back for 2 years so we could finish school, I could finish my A-levels, X, Y, and Z, all those things, and gave us time to develop as a band and that. But we never had to go and shout about how good we were to anyone. It was always the other way around. And I tend to find what you see now, or certainly in some cases, is it tends to be a battle who can shout the loudest, like, well, come and watch my band. You know what I mean? My band's amazing. We are the best thing. You know, like, we never understood that. And I'll tell you why. It's because we were just four musicians that loved playing our instruments and loved making music. You know, us three at jam, and Rob would stand there and listening, and then we'd hit on something that was good, and Rob would just lose his mind. Do you know what I mean? You'd see the way he danced on stage back in the day, back in the early days, he loses. Might do that in the practice room. Do you know what I mean? That's not a performance. Seriously, that's not a performance. And it would never have been a performance. That was Rob. That was a Tuesday afternoon or a Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. Do you know what I mean? When we, you know, after we got signed, so to speak, and we got held back for those 2 years, we did have things like our own practice room. That was the beauty. Do you know what I mean? We got signed effectively at 16 by a management company, and then they nurtured us for 2 years until we were 18, at which point we signed a record deal, because obviously you can't sign a record deal before you're 18. It'd have to be signed by your parents. Anyway, so in those 2 years, we were locked away in a room, just, you know, pleasing ourselves. You know, it's not like a lot of the time as well, when you get a deal, it would be the record label dictating everything. You know, because we had so many record labels fighting over us, we just literally were, you know, we were in a position where it's like, no, these are the terms. It's not like we have to, again, very unique situation. And it's very difficult for me to have a, even like an appropriate context, because don't get me wrong, there will be tons of bands out there who did really graft and had to really graft at their instruments. As I say, I picked up a guitar and nonchalantly played it for 3 months, and all of a sudden I was better than the majority of people, certainly locally, that I was seen playing guitar. And it's same with Stu. Do you know what I mean? Stu's an absolute machine on the bass. And Phil is one of the most unique drummers you'll ever come across. And what he does with, you know, a relatively small kit. You know, man, you see these drummers with bloody 20, 30 piece drum kits or whatever. You know, I've seen Phil make the same racket with, this, you know, just the bare minimum, because it's just, call it, well, yeah, it's talent, man. Do you know what I mean? Like, if, suppose it's a lot like young footballers who are just absolutely unbelievable. People come to them. It's not the other way around. Do you know what I mean? They just get to sit there as we did and just, you know, be like, all right, well, what are you saying? Because to be honest, we just want to go home and go sit in practice room that we've got. That, you know, that was just amazing to us at that age to be, you know, some, we get driven down by his parents. Do you know what I mean? 17 years old with a practice room in town, a massive, you know, a pretty big, and our own place. It's not like, you know, most of the time you have to rock up and pull your own gear out of the car and set it up. Our gear was set up permanently. We just roll in, you know, pick guitar up.
And straight to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's quite a good link. That's a great message as well for our listeners, in terms of just like, because a lot of our musicians that listen to this sort of around the UK are that age, and it's just a good message to just, you know, master your craft and get cracking. Do you know what I mean? With what you've just said there. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a good link into my next question, which was, when I first became aware of the music, the landscape, the musical landscape and industry itself was so different in a, yeah. in a lot of good ways, I feel. But what there wasn't, which is good, is there was less, which I call like musical pollution. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't as much social media and rubbish online and all of that sort of stuff. It was more about, you know, organic word of mouth buzz and just quality rising through, as you've just alluded to with yourselves, obviously. What do you think in terms of the current industry now, what do you think are the pluses and what do you think are the negatives, you feel?
Well, I suppose that's quite a difficult question, really, because I wouldn't say that I'd be, you know, fully privy to even... I mean, I suppose I am to a degree, and maybe more so than most people would be. But, yeah, I mean, as you say, the industry was very, very, very different back when, you know, we were, whatever you'd say, still around. I don't know how you refer to it, but still operational anyway, if that's the way you want to refer to it. It was incredibly different, and I think now... I think the thing is it shrunk so much. And I know there might be numbers out there that will say, well, this is growing and that's growing, but it's not really. Do you know what I mean? Music as a whole, you know, and the music industry. I mean, and you have to realize that the music industry is compartmentalized into so many different, I don't know whether you refer to them as tiers, but certainly sections and certain aspects of it never really change or suffer. Do you know what I mean? The very top of the pop industry. Do you know what I mean? That is a machine that learns how to navigate and negotiate a changing business landscape, because that's what has happened as much as anything. You know, when the pot shrinks, everyone who gets something from the pot has to work out how to squeeze more out of it. So as a result, you know, your top, you know, your real pop stuff, that doesn't particularly suffer. But that is, as I say, that is separate, I think, from, you know, as I say, the other parts of the music industry. And I think for bands like us of a certain size, I think, to be honest, it's a very double-edged sword. And the more I'm spending time back in the music industry, so to speak, at whatever level, the more I am learning, and there are positives to the situation as it is. One of the positives is the rise in vinyl. Now, that enables someone like us to release a record on our own record label. Do you know what I mean? And that's setting up a record label isn't as flamboyant or extravagant as it sounds. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit like setting up an email address. If you write the name, then you've got a record label. Effectively, but yeah, what that basically means is, for example, with the Temple Newsom Live, we've released that on our own record label, and because of which we get, you know, however you want to look at this, we get more financial reward. And if we released it through a major label, like traditionally back in the day, we'd have got much, much less. Being signed to a label will always carry the same compromises in terms of what you're getting back out of your own creative work. But with social media and with the tools that are available to you to do, you know, even your own self-promotion, I mean, it is different for us because we have a legacy, obviously, which is rooted in, like we've been talking about, back in the day, you know, when we were what we were. We have that legacy to be able to come back now and release something through a fantastic direct-to-customer, call them D2C, direct-to-customer record label, such as Townsend. So that is still, in a sense, Townsend will still get your music out and stuff like that, but they don't give you any advance. Do you know what I mean? Not like traditionally. Traditionally, when you sign a record deal, you get what's called an advance, basically, which is the money you use to buy equipment, record the album, tour, whatever you need to do. If you do it with a direct customer record label, then the record label becomes the middleman. It doesn't become the benefactor, do you know what I mean? Or the beneficiary, I can never remember which way around, but it doesn't become the person who takes all the money in that case. You know, the artist does. So the other thing you've got to bear in mind as well is downloads and streaming platforms. Now, this is where I could get on my high horse quite easily. I'm not going to, but effectively things like Spotify, Apple iTunes, all that sort of stuff, any streaming platform, artists make nothing from. You know, literally pennies. So
crazy, even on the sort of massively popular tracks now, it's like nothing, is it? It's absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing. So it's difficult, really, because everything, all that is geared towards a consumer, which I understand, but from an artist perspective. So, for example, we released Temple Newsom through Townsend on our own thing, where if you buy it from us, you're supporting us. You're not giving your money to Apple. You're not giving your money to some faceless record label. You are giving the money to four lads who made music that you love. Do you know what I mean? So the issue is, and I don't think a lot of people realize this, is that we, you know, I for example, again, spent a lot of time on social media. Like, look, this is our shop on Townsend. These are the deals you can get on things, and you get the free stream link. Do you know what I mean? Blah blah blah. And then people are like, well, can I get it on Spotify? And like, without a hint of irony, do you know what I mean? But I'm learning that they don't realize what they're basically doing, because what they're, you know, I think it's a case of they think, well, I'm paying my Spotify subscription, so I want it through Spotify. It's like, yeah, but we get nothing for that. So you are, in a sense, getting it for free then, if you weigh up your however much Spotify is a month and however much you consume out of it. I bet when you weigh it up, you're really getting it for free, aren't you? That's what you're saying. You want it for free and you don't want to support us or cover the cost that it, you know, because it costs a lot of money to make this record. That's a difference, you know. We've literally done it. I've gone to the pressing plant, you know what I mean? The money's come out of our account to pay for it. It's not some faceless record label that supported this. So, to answer your question, which was a very lengthy answer, but you are right. If I think you said that there are positives and negatives to the state of the industry now, and I think I have laid them out there. Do you know what I mean? Now, don't get me wrong. If you're a massive size band, well, I mean, even then, do you know what I mean? You can still cut. Record labels can be cut out nowadays, especially if you're clever or with your, you know, whether you refer to it as viral market. You know, if there's anyone out there listening to this, or anyone, like you say, your listeners, young listeners, people who want to get into music, like, I mean, it's difficult to say this about yourself, but you know, if you've got strong personality and you're not obnoxious, do you know what I mean? Don't get me wrong. I suppose an element of being obnoxious might get people's attention, but there's no doubt that you can. It's hard to describe, really, but you can go through the back door, so to speak. You can rise up through your own social media, and very quickly with the doing the right things, and you see it becomes very complicated and almost contrived to a degree. But look at Nick Hodgson from the Kaiser Chiefs.
Oh yeah, the drummer.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know,
big songwriter as well, isn't he?
Well, he was the key songwriter in the band. You know, Nick. Well, certainly, Nick and Ricky. Sorry, I'm not doing a Ricky disservice at all. But they Rick and Nick jointly brought that band to what it was. And again, taste aside, what anyone thinks, I had a fascinating conversation with him, you know, because as I described to you, we came from a very organic place of just, it's all about music and, you know, we do things naturally. And I sort of said casually, you know, was it the same for you guys? And he almost laughed and were like, no, it was a plan. It was a plan that I had a little notebook that I carried around everywhere. And it was a plan that developed over time. And then whenever we were sat somewhere, we'd talk and we'd plan, which is very much like what me and Rob did, but in a different way. Because I think what they did is they sat down and created a blueprint for the perfect pop band, you know, sort of rock pop, whatever you want to describe it anyway. But, you know, the perfect mainstream band that would get as much attention, as much airplay, and sell as many records as possible so he could retire by the time he was 35. Do you know what I mean? That was their plan. But there's no wrong or right way of doing it. But like I say, from my own perspective, we just came from a place of being all about loving our... And don't get me wrong, like... I mean, like, I have something called hyperfocus as a result of ADHD that just... things become an obsession. It's not a choice for me. You know, when I discovered guitar, I became obsessed with it, became obsessed with learning how to play it and learning how to do whatever I could with it. That was just... I was in no control of that. It was just a whim that grew and an obsession. And, you know, a lot of the deal with the lads a degree as well, a lot of the drive in the music came from me and that sort of burning obsession that I suddenly get for something. And, you know, that I was often the one who'd be pulling ideas out of the jams we were having, stopping people and going, look, we've recorded that. Let's just play that back because that's the best thing I've ever heard. And you were doing like a vocal. If you just add that bit to it, you know, it's suddenly, you know, that's what I used to love, was almost like producing on the fly in the room. Do you know what I mean? And just taking an idea and being able to hear where it could and should go. These were all things that were just natural instincts to me that I love doing, became obsessed with doing, I suppose. You can't force it, basically. You can't force any of it. And you've got to be real. I think as long as you're real, although that flies in the face of what I say about Nick Hodgson and that, but like I said, it's different when you've got a hard plan. Do you know what I mean? Like a hard and fast plan that you're just going to follow. But yeah, certainly with social media, you can self-promote yourself. What you've got to realize as well is you don't have to take over the world to be successful in the music industry. Do you know, I know the cost of living and stuff and, you know, people need more money annually to survive, obviously. But you don't need to set yourself a goal where you're trying to get to space. Do you know what I mean? You could just be getting to the top of a 20th floor building and you'd be pretty good there. Do you know what I mean? If you can get your own little profile where you make a record, you make an album and you can maybe sell 500 copies of that in this day and age, that's great. And that's a big difference between now and back then, is that like back then, you know, if you were making an impact, you were selling, I don't know, if the charts, for example, I think back in the day, you'd be shifting 100,000 units, you know, 60,000 units, 80,000 units, depending on obviously how the week had gone for every artist. But like nowadays, the charts, if, you know, you'd be getting to 4,000 units, will be putting you in the top 10. The official charts, 4,000 units.
Yeah, you know what I mean? A different look to the charts now. It's mad.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, time is absolutely flying at the moment in the podcast. What I wanted to sort of as we bring things to a close, it's flown by. Is for our young listeners, what would be lovely to know from yourself is, what's the best bit of advice in terms of your musical journey that you've been given from someone?
That I've been given from someone.
That's always stayed with you. Could be like from someone you class as a mentor or like a producer or someone in that sort of ilk.
I've taken so much from so many, but that's something that I always did. I mean, it's a bit of a tangent, but that's something that I always did. Anyone we ever worked with, that's, do you know what I mean? Because I just never leave them at, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? What's that button do? Can I tweak that? What's that do? But by the end of it, you know, come the third album, I was able to go home and buy myself a setup and a Pro Tools setup and effectively record the third album in my bedroom, which is what we did. And then we took it down to Townhouse and did it with Flood. But anyway, in terms of bits of advice from people who've been influential to me, well, yeah, all right, go on then, fair enough. So, Tim Vigan, our manager, I think one of the things he said, one of the most important things he said, which I don't think I probably paid attention to at the time, but it resonates massively now. We never got ridiculously too big for our boots or anything like that. But like I said earlier, we always treated the attention we were getting with a certain element of almost irritation. Do you know what I mean? I think, you know, like, it's not like we were all sat there going, oh yeah, this is brilliant. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what, we've got to fly to Japan for 2 weeks and it's just interviews from 8 till 8 every day, all day. What? When do we get to make the second album? And that was a bit, again, another tangent, but that were a big problem for us because we had such a big first record and it did so well in all so many territories. It were a case of that. You'd do 6 weeks somewhere going all around the world, you'd get back and the managers are like, look, they want you over here and, you know, it's going to be worthwhile, so you need to do it. You know, we toured that first album for 3 years and that was very much the case of, I was just like, look, when do we get chance to write the next record? That's why you have the famous second album syndrome, because
there's no time.
Exactly. And to even be in line for second album syndrome, you had to have had a big first album. Obviously, you can't have one without the other. You've got your entire youth. You've got your entire youth to create the sound that gets you that attention. And that's another plus about keeping things DIY, as you would call it, with, you know, releasing things yourself, direct to customer labels, staying away from the major labels.
A piece of advice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've gone on the right tangent. And so, yeah, basically, the piece of advice was don't take it for granted and enjoy every second of it. Obviously, I mean, that's when you get to a point where you can take it for granted, I suppose. That'd be the piece of advice that I'd give to anyone who finds himself in a position where they're getting a lot of attention for the music they're making, and especially when you're not having to really, really work hard for it. You've got to be in it for the right reasons. There's no fast track. You've got to do it because you love it and because you're driven to do it. And then if you start to get to a point where you could be in the mix, it's very difficult to try and say if you do X, Y, Z, you'll get this result. But you certainly have to go into things and make it fun. You have to be a unit and you've got to have a good vibe. You've got to have something about you, man. You've got to have some vibe either as a musician, as a character, as a person. You've got to have something to say. But I think number one is doing it for the love of it and not just because you want to wear a leather jacket and, you know what I mean, all that sort of stuff. I think that really would have to be the fundamental piece of advice is do it because you love music and you love making music. Don't see the music you are making as, you know, just a stepping stone to getting a profile. Do you know what I mean? In my opinion, I just don't think you're ever going to get anywhere doing that, really. It's got to all be about making great songs and getting out there and playing gigs. Because that's one thing we did do, as much as people did come running to us, especially the industry side of it, because we were so sheltered in that, and we did like when we first started, especially when we got some money behind us and that, we did three-week tours, like one of the North, one of the Midlands, and one of the South. Do you know what I mean? And we literally played loads of towns across the country. Do you know what I mean? Across that period. I think that it was where we built our real following. And that was amazing. Some of the best times of his lives, that. Do you know what I mean? It were absolutely amazing, the gigs we were doing back then, people hearing us for the first time. But yeah, you've got to be in it for the right reasons. You've got to love making music and be driven to make music and, you know, be driven to impress yourself. I think that's all I would ever try to do. Certainly when I'm playing guitar, is like, oh, try to outdo myself. You know, I was never really too bothered about,
sort of, you know, push your skill sets, I think.
Yeah, push your skill sets. Very difficult, because I think you know, I don't know what it's like now, but certainly back in the day, it could get very competitive between bands, and especially like in a small town where there's like a lot of bands, and it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, I don't know, it just becomes very, well, almost bitchy, do you know what I mean? And especially if one of them were to do the unholy thing of actually getting some success, and then suddenly everyone from that little town's like, oh yeah, they're rubbish, I hate them, they sold out, and do you know what I mean? It can be a very cutthroat, well, it is a very cutthroat industry, and you've got to have laser vision on your own goal. You don't have to be a virtuoso on your instrument. You don't have to be. Do you know what I mean? It certainly, don't get me wrong, certainly helps, because then when you're just doing riffs and stuff, you can do it in your sleep. Do you know what I mean? But you've got to find like-minded people who don't just want to waste their youth like chatting up girls and stuff like that. You know, I'm not being funny, but like, if that's all you're about, you ain't got no man. Do you know what I mean? That can come, don't get me wrong, but you've got to be driven by, I'm going to pick up my guitar, get home and express myself. You know, the rest of the world noise is gone, and that's all I care about right now. And you can't force great art. It's got to come from someone who's got something about them, man. And if you can get two or three of them people of that ilk in a room, you're onto a winner.
Just to, it's been absolutely brilliant to have you on, and there's absolutely acres that our young musicians and performers can take from what you said, acres today. There's been some real sort of nuggets of magic in there, so I appreciate that. Yeah, just to finish off on sort of a warm positive note, we'll make sure to put in the episode notes, we'll make sure to put the links to purchase the Live at Temple Newsom. And we'll also put a link to Music and More, the podcast you do with Pete, which is great for anyone who wants to listen. It's brilliant. Yeah, just to finish off on, because it looks magic from what I've watched and what I've heard, did it feel like a full circle magic experience to be back in Yorkshire playing Temple Newsom?
Yeah, and then some. Absolute dream come true, to be honest. It was, you know, for the 10, 11 years afterwards, after when we split up, and I'd obviously by that point grown used to the idea that I wasn't going to be involved in music ever again. Obviously that's changed now, because I found the love of it again, and I'm releasing my own album really soon. My solo album comes out. But yeah, having gone through all that, to get the opportunity to play, and like you rightly say, Temple Newsom, a hometown gig at Temple. I mean, it would have been amazing if it was, I don't know, in Manchester or Glasgow or Dundee or anywhere. It would have been brilliant. But to be in our hometown, and not only that, like at Temple Newsom, because as I've detailed in my own podcast, you know, that we played on those fields as children with our families, you know, in the summer, do you know what I mean? When you couldn't move there because that's where everyone went. You took your kids to Temple Newsom and adults sat down, and that's how we grew up. So yeah, and that was arriving on that site and seeing the stage and seeing how big it all was. I mean, there are videos of it on my Facebook and on my Instagram of me walking up the steps to the stage and going out the front and just looking like, oh, that was the thing that was weird about it. I mean, we were, you know, back in the day, we were pretty big. You know, we were on Top of the Pops two or three times. Not I think we sure. had, yeah, I think it was twice. Did we do it the third time? Or when were we in America? No, I'm sure we did it three times. Either way, we, you know, we did all the US talk shows. We were a pretty big deal for quite a while. And then, but we never did anything of that size in the UK back then, unless you count festivals, I suppose. Obviously, we've headlined stages at festivals, etc. But, you know, to play your own hometown gig to over 10,000, 12,000 people at a place, you know, close to your heart and locally like Temple Newsom, that's it's difficult, really, because you look at it and you're like, oh, God, it's not going to get much better than that, is it? But, you know, I think that we all enjoyed it all so much that, you know, look, it's not a case that you're going to hear a new record that's written now by the music or anything like that, or that there's going to be any big tours. It's not the way it's going to happen. But I would love to think that we would do a similar thing to Temple Newsom at some point, or even some points in the future. You know, some other big one-off event with a warm-up or something like that. I'd love to do that.
Well, Adam, it's been a great pleasure, and I mean, like I say, there's acres from our conversation today that our sort of young audience can take sort of notes and look to progress their careers using. And thanks so much for your time. It's been a real joy. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem at all, mate. Anytime. And if you ever want me to come back on, or I'm more than happy to do that. I'm quite comfortable sat behind a microphone chatting about the music, because it's something I love very much. So yeah, no problem.
And you're a top guy. Thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
No problem. Cheers. Thank you very much. Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.